Chapter 9. Results of Preaching. The fields are white for harvesting. Focus of chapter. Jehovah has made the seeds of kingdom truth grow. Paragraphs 1 and 2. Question A. Why are the disciples puzzled? Question B. Jesus speaks about what type of harvest? The disciples are puzzled. Jesus has told them, "Lift up your eyes and view the fields, that they are white for harvesting." John 4:35. They gaze in the direction to which Jesus gestures, but all they see are fields that are not white, but green, the color of recently sprouted barley. What harvest? They likely reason. It will take months before the harvest takes place. Jesus, though, is not speaking about a literal harvest. Instead, he is using this occasion to teach his disciples two important lessons concerning a spiritual harvest, a harvest of people. What are those lessons? To find out, let us consider the account in more detail. A call to action and a promise of joy. Paragraph 3, question A. What possibly prompted Jesus to say, "The fields are white for harvesting"? Question B. How did Jesus clarify his statement? Jesus' conversation with his disciples occurred at the end of 30 CE, near the Samaritan town of Sychar. While his disciples entered the town, Jesus stayed behind at a well where he shared spiritual truths with a woman who quickly grasped the importance of his teachings. When the disciples returned to Jesus, the woman hurried off to Sychar to tell her neighbors the amazing things she had learned. Her report aroused great interest, and many of her neighbors rushed toward the well to meet Jesus. Possibly at that moment, as Jesus gazed beyond the fields into the distance and saw a crowd of Samaritans approaching, he stated, "View the fields, that they are white for harvesting." The footnote reads, "Jesus' remark about the fields being white could allude to the white robes that may have been worn by the crowd of Samaritans whom Jesus saw approaching." End of footnote. Then, to clarify that he meant not a literal harvest, but a spiritual one, Jesus added, "The reaper is gathering fruit for everlasting life." John 4, 5-30 and 36. Paragraph 4, question A. What two lessons about the harvest did Jesus teach? Question B. What questions will we consider? What two important lessons about the spiritual harvest did Jesus teach? First, the work is urgent. His declaration that the fields are white for harvesting was a call to action for his followers. To impress upon his disciples the degree of urgency, Jesus added, "Already the reaper is receiving wages." Yes, the harvest had already begun. There was no time for delay. Second, the workers are joyful. "Sowers and reapers will rejoice together," said Jesus. John 4, 35b and 36. Just as Jesus himself must have rejoiced on seeing that many of the Samaritans put faith in him, so his disciples would experience deep joy as they worked whole-souled in the harvest. This first century account has special meaning for us because it illustrates what is happening today during the greatest spiritual harvest of all time. When did this modern-day harvest begin? Who have a share in it? What have been the results? Our King takes the lead in the greatest harvest of all time. Paragraph 5, question, who takes the lead in the global harvest, and how does John's vision indicate that the work is urgent? In a vision given to the Apostle John, Jehovah reveals that he assigned Jesus to take the lead in a global harvest of people. Revelation 14:14-16 reads, "Then I saw, and look, a white cloud, and seated on the cloud was someone like a son of man, with a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. Another angel emerged from the temple sanctuary, calling with a loud voice to the one seated on the cloud, "Put your sickle in and reap, because the hour has come to reap, for the harvest of the earth is fully ripe." And the one seated on the cloud thrust his sickle into the earth, and the earth was reaped. In this vision, Jesus is described as having a crown and a sickle. The golden crown on Jesus' head confirms his position as ruling king. The sharp sickle in his hand confirms his role as harvester. By stating through an angel that the harvest of the earth is fully ripe, Jehovah emphasizes that the work is urgent. Indeed, the hour has come to reap. There's no time for delay. In response to God's command, "Put your sickle in," Jesus thrusts in his sickle, and the earth is reaped, that is, people of the earth are reaped. This exciting vision reminds us that, again, the fields are white for harvesting. Does this vision help us to determine when the global harvest began? Yes. Paragraph 6, Question A, when did the harvest season begin? Question B, when did the actual harvest of the earth begin? Explain. Since John's vision in Revelation chapter 14 shows Jesus, the harvester, wearing a crown, verse 14, his appointment as king in 1914 had already taken place. Sometime after that, Jesus is commanded to start the harvest, verse 15. The same order of events is seen in Jesus' parable about the harvest of the wheat, where he states, "The harvest is a conclusion of a system of things." Thus, the harvest season and the conclusion of this system of things began at the same time, in 1914. Later, in the harvest season, the actual harvesting began, Matthew 13, 30 and 39. Looking back from our vantage point in time, we can see that the harvest began some years after Jesus started ruling as king. First, from 1914 until the early part of 1919, Jesus carried out a cleansing work among his anointed followers. Then, in 1919, the harvest of the earth began. Without delay, Jesus used the newly appointed faithful slave to help our brothers see the urgency of the preaching work. Consider what happened. Paragraph 7, Question A. What examination helped our brothers to see the urgency of the preaching work? Question B. What were our brothers encouraged to do? In July 1920, the Watchtower stated, "It seems evident from an examination of the Scriptures that a great privilege is granted unto the church in delivering a message concerning the kingdom. For instance, Isaiah's prophetic words helped the brothers to see that the kingdom news had to be announced worldwide. How such a work could be accomplished, they did not know, but they trusted that Jehovah would open the way for them." Isaiah 59:1 reads, "Look, the hand of Jehovah is not too short to save, nor is his ear too dull to hear." As a result of this clearer view about the urgency of the preaching work, our brothers were encouraged to step up their activities. How did the brothers respond? Paragraph 8, Question. In 1921, what two facts about the preaching work did our brothers grasp? In December 1921, the Watchtower announced, "It has been the best year of all, and greater numbers of people have heard the message of truth during 1921 than in any previous year." The magazine added, "There is much yet to be done. Let us do it with a joyful heart." Note how the brothers grasped the same two important facts about the preaching work that Jesus had impressed upon his apostles. The work is urgent, and the workers are joyful. Paragraph 9, Question A. In 1954, what did the Watchtower state about the harvest work, and why? Question B. What worldwide increase in publishers has taken place during the past 50 years? During the 1930s, after the brothers understood that a great crowd of other sheep would respond to the kingdom message, the preaching work intensified further. The result? The number of those preaching the kingdom message rose from 41,000 in 1934 to 500,000 in 1953. The Watchtower of December 1, 1954, rightly concluded, "It is Jehovah's Spirit and the power of His Word that have accomplished this great worldwide harvest." The result of the harvest, foretold in vivid word pictures. Paragraphs 10 and 11. Question. In the parable of the mustard grain, what aspects of the seed's growth are highlighted? In his kingdom parables, Jesus foretold in vivid language the result of the harvest work. Let us consider the parable about the mustard grain and the one about the leaven. We will focus particularly on how they have been fulfilled in the time of the end. The parable of the mustard grain. A man plants a mustard grain. It then grows into a tree in which birds find shelter. Matthew 13:31 and 32 reads, "He presented another illustration to them, saying, 'The kingdom of the heavens is like a mustard grain that a man took and planted in his field. It is, in fact, the tiniest of all the seeds, but when it has grown, it is the largest of the vegetable plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds of heaven come and find lodging among its branches.'" What aspects of the growth of the seed are highlighted in this parable? 1. The extent of the growth is amazing. The tiniest of all the seeds becomes a tree with great branches. Mark 4:31 and 32. 2. Growth is assured. When the seed has been sown, it grows. Jesus does not say, "It may grow." No, he states, "It grows." Its growth is unstoppable. 3. The growing tree attracts visitors and provides lodging. The birds of heaven come and find lodging under its shadow. How do these three aspects apply to the modern-day spiritual harvest? Paragraph 12. Question. How does the parable of the mustard grain apply to today's harvest? 1. Extent of growth. The parable highlights the growth of the kingdom message and the Christian congregation. Since 1919, zealous harvest workers have been gathered into the restored Christian congregation. At that time, the number of workers was small, but it grew rapidly. In fact, its growth from the early 1900s to today has been phenomenal. 2. Assurance. The growth of the Christian congregation has been unstoppable. No matter how many layers of rock-like opposition God's enemies placed upon the tiny seed, it kept growing, pushing aside all obstacles. 3. Lodging. The birds of heaven that find lodging in the tree represent many millions of right-hearted individuals from some 240 lands who have responded to the kingdom message by becoming part of the Christian congregation. There they receive spiritual food, refreshment, and protection. Paragraph 13. Question. The parable of the leaven highlights what aspects of growth? The parable of the leaven. After a woman adds some leaven to a mass of flour, the leaven ferments the whole mass. Matthew 13:33 reads, "He told them another illustration. The kingdom of the heavens is like leaven that a woman took and mixed with three large measures of flour until the whole mass was fermented." What aspects of growth are highlighted in this parable? Let us consider two. 1. Growth causes transformation. The leaven spread until the whole mass was fermented. 2. Growth is pervasive. The leaven ferments all three large measures of flour, the entire mass. How do these two aspects apply to the modern-day spiritual harvest? Paragraph 14. Question. How does the parable of the leaven apply to today's harvest? 1. Transformation. The leaven stands for the kingdom message, and the mass of flour represents mankind. As leaven causes a change in flour after the two are mixed together, so the kingdom message causes a transformation in the hearts of individuals after they accept that message. 2. Pervasive. The spreading of the leaven stands for the spreading of the kingdom message. Leaven works its way through the dough until it is spread throughout the entire mass. Similarly, the kingdom message is spread to the most distant part of the earth. Acts 1:8. This aspect of the parable also indicates that even in lands where our work is under ban, the kingdom message will spread, though our preaching activities in those parts of the earth may largely go unnoticed. Paragraph 15. Question. How have the words found at Isaiah 60, verses 5 and 22, been fulfilled? Some 800 years before Jesus spoke those parables, Jehovah, by means of Isaiah, foretold in memorable language the scope of the modern-day spiritual harvest and the joy this harvest would cause. Jehovah describes people from far away streaming toward his organization. Directing himself to a woman, who today is represented by the anointed remnant on earth, he states, "You will see and become radiant, and your heart will throb and overflow, because the wealth of the sea will be directed to you. The resources of the nations will come to you." Isaiah 60, verses 1, 4, 5, and 9. How true those words are! Today, long-time servants of Jehovah are indeed radiant with joy as they observe how the number of kingdom publishers in their lands has increased from just a few to many thousands. Why all servants of Jehovah have reason to rejoice. Paragraphs 16 and 17. Question. What is one reason why the sower and the reaper rejoice together? You will recall that Jesus told his apostles, "The reaper is gathering fruit for everlasting life, so that the sower and the reaper may rejoice together." John 4:36. How do we rejoice together in the global harvest? In several ways. Let us consider three. First, we rejoice to see Jehovah's role in the work. When we preach the kingdom message, we sow seed. When we help someone to become a disciple of Christ, we harvest fruitage. And all of us feel deep joy as we observe with awe how Jehovah causes kingdom seed to sprout and grow tall. Mark 4:27 and 28. Some seed that we scatter sprouts later and is harvested by others. You may have had an experience similar to that of Joan, a Christian sister in Britain who was baptized 60 years ago. She said, "I have met individuals who told me that I planted a seed in their heart when I preached to them years ago. Unknown to me, other witnesses later studied the Bible with them and helped them to become servants of Jehovah. I rejoiced that the seed I planted grew and was harvested." 1 Corinthians 3, 6 and 7 reads, "I planted, Apollos watered, but God kept making it grow, so that neither is the one who plants anything, nor is the one who waters, but God who makes it grow." The following is supplementary information. Jehovah made it possible. Jesus declared, "Things impossible with men are possible with God." Luke 18:27. Many of us have experienced the truth of that statement. Despite all the efforts of those who want to stop the preaching work, Jehovah has helped us to carry it out. Zachary Elegbe, aged 66, baptized in 1963, recalls how a ban against the activities of Jehovah's Witnesses in Benin actually helped the brothers.
In 1976, when we had 2,300 publishers, our work was banned, and the government ordered the ban to be broadcast in every local language. That was unheard of. Though Benin's population speaks more than 60 languages, radio programs back then were usually broadcast in only five. So, when the ban was broadcast in all local languages, many thousands of people living in remote areas heard of us for the very first time. They wondered, who are Jehovah's Witnesses, and why are they banned? Later, when we reached those areas, many accepted the truth in short order.
Today, there are more than 11,500 witnesses in Benin. Maria Zinich, aged 74, baptized in 1957.
When I was about 12 years old, our whole family was exiled from Ukraine to Siberia, Russia. Despite all efforts of the government to silence us throughout the former Soviet Union, our numbers kept increasing. Seeing that amazing growth, in spite of harsh opposition, convinced me that this is Jehovah's work. Nobody is able to stop it.
Another sister named Maria, aged 73, baptized in 1960, noted,
"As a result of deporting our brothers to Siberia, the government caused many isolated people there to get a chance to hear the truth."
Jesus Martin, aged 77, baptized in 1955, recalls,
"When I learned the truth, there were 300 witnesses here in Spain. In 1960, the repression against us became brutal. The government ordered the police to snuff out Jehovah's Witnesses. At that time, it was hard to imagine how we would ever be able to preach the good news throughout the country. Everything seemed to be stacked against us. But today, there are nearly 111,000 witnesses in Spain. Having witnessed how that growth has taken place despite opposition reinforces my conviction that with Jehovah on our side, nothing is impossible."
Returning to the chapter, paragraph 18, question, what reason for joy is mentioned at 1 Corinthians 3:8? Second, we remain joyful workers when we keep in mind that Paul stated, "Each person will receive his own reward according to his own work." 1 Corinthians 3:8. The reward is given according to the work, not according to the results of that work. How heartening that assurance is for those preaching in territories where there is little response. In God's eyes, every witness who wholeheartedly shares in the sowing work is bearing much fruit and therefore has reason to rejoice. John 15:8. Paragraph 19, question A. How does Jesus' prophecy found at Matthew 24:14 relate to our joy? Question B. What should we keep in mind even if we do not personally succeed in making a disciple? Third, we rejoice that our work fulfills prophecy. Consider Jesus' answer to his apostles when they asked, "What will be the sign of your presence and of the conclusion of the system of things?" He told them that one feature of that sign would be a global preaching work. Was he speaking of the disciple-making work? No. He said, "This good news of the kingdom will be preached in all the inhabited earth for a witness." Matthew 24:3-14. Thus, kingdom preaching, sowing seed, is a feature of the sign. Hence, as we preach the good news of the kingdom, we keep in mind that even if we do not succeed in making a disciple, we do succeed in giving a witness. The footnote reads, that vital truth was already understood by the early Bible students. Zion's Watchtower of November 15, 1895, stated, "If but little wheat can be garnered, abundant testimony to the truth can at least be borne. All can preach the gospel." End of footnote. Yes, no matter how people respond, we share in fulfilling Jesus' prophecy and have the honor to serve as God's fellow workers. 1 Corinthians 3:9. What good reason to rejoice! From the rising of the sun to its setting. Paragraphs 20 and 21. Question A. How are the words of Malachi 1:11 being fulfilled? Question B. As to the harvest work, What are you determined to do, and why? In the first century, Jesus helped his apostles to see that the harvest work was urgent. From 1919 onward, Jesus has helped his modern-day disciples to grasp the same truth. In response, God's people have intensified their activities. In fact, the harvest work has proved to be unstoppable. As foretold by the prophet Malachi, the preaching work is being carried out today from the rising of the sun to its setting. Malachi 1:11. Yes, from sunrise to sunset, from east to west, no matter where they are on earth, sowers and reapers work and rejoice together. And from sunrise to sunset, from morning till evening, or all day long, we work with a sense of urgency. As we look back today over some 100 years and see how a small group of God's servants has grown into a mighty nation, our heart does indeed throb and overflow with joy. Isaiah 60:5-22. May that joy and our love for Jehovah, the master of the harvest, impel each one of us to keep on doing our share in completing the greatest harvest of all time. Luke 10:2. How real is the kingdom to you? What has the kingdom accomplished in relation to the spiritual harvest? How do the parables of the mustard grain and the leaven encourage you to carry out your ministry? What reasons do you have to rejoice in the ministry? The following is supplementary information. How two tracks touched two hearts in the Amazon. A faithful 91-year-old Christian elder named Antonio Simoes fondly remembers how his father and his uncle found the truth by means of two tracts published by Jehovah's Witnesses. "Do you want to hear about it?" he asks his visitors. "We would love to," they say. Antonio's kind eyes light up, and with a smile, he sits down to tell his story.
My father, Zeno, was a Baptist preacher. In 1931, he traveled to a remote part of the Amazon forest to visit a church member. In her home, he noticed two Bible tracts. She had found them in the church, but she didn't know who left them. One tract spoke about hell, the other about the resurrection. Father was touched by what he read. He immediately thought about his brother-in-law, Guilherme, who had often told him, "I don't believe in hellfire. A God of love couldn't create such a place." Eager to show the tracks to Guilherme, Father got into his canoe and paddled for 8 hours to Manaquiri, a settlement near Manaus, where Guilherme was living. After Father and Uncle Guilherme examined the tracts, both said, "This is the truth." Right away, they wrote to the branch office in Brazil asking for literature. Father resigned as a pastor, and he and my uncle began sharing the Bible's message in that isolated area. The people responded so well that within a year, a congregation was formed in Manaquiri. Before long, 70 villagers attended the meetings, making it, at the time, the largest congregation in Brazil.
Antonio pauses. Then he asks,
"Isn't it wonderful to hear how the kingdom message entered the Amazon?"
"Indeed it is. Two tiny scattered seeds, two small Bible tracts, took root in the vast Amazon forest and sprouted into a flourishing congregation. And today, the 83-year-old Manaquiri congregation is no longer the only congregation in Brazil's Amazonas state, but one of 143. How the small one has become a mighty nation. The little one will become 1,000, and the small one a mighty nation. I myself, Jehovah, will speed it up in its own time. Isaiah 60:22. How has that prophecy come true? How has its fulfillment affected longtime witnesses around the world? Börje Nilsson, aged 84, baptized in 1943.
I remember an anointed brother who was a coal porter in the 1920s. When he received nearly half of Sweden as his assignment, he obediently began preaching. And how his work and that of other faithful ones has been rewarded. Today we have over 22,000 publishers. Though I'm now up in years, I want to continue obediently in Jehovah's service. Who knows what surprises Jehovah still has in store for us.
Eugene Estahese, age 83, baptized in 1942.
Today I look back in wonderment as I see how the number of Jehovah's people in South Africa has grown from some 1,500 in 1942 to over 94,000 today. It is absolutely faith-strengthening to be part of such a vast organization.
Keith Gayden, aged 82, baptized in 1948.
Witnessing how the number of publishers in Britain increased from some 13,700 in 1948 to nearly 137,000 today demonstrates to me that this is Jehovah's work. By human power, it would have been impossible, but Jehovah is the one doing wonders. Exodus 15:11.
Ulrich Krolop, aged 77, baptized in 1952.
After World War II, the congregations in Germany were invigorated by the active spirit of the witnesses who had endured Nazi persecution. People needed comfort, and we could give it without hesitation, because the witnesses had not participated in that terrible war. Over the past 60 years, I have observed how God's Spirit has guided His people. Today, we have over 164,000 witnesses. What a wonderful result!
Maria Brunetskaya, age 77, baptized in 1955.
To avoid arrest, I was baptized at night under the cover of darkness. Later, my husband was sent to a distant labor camp for being a witness. Cautiously, I continued preaching in my village here in Russia, and several neighbors accepted the truth. Back then, we had few brothers and sisters. I rejoice that today there are over 168,000 witnesses in Russia.
Kimiko Yamano, age 79, baptized in 1954.
When I learned in 1970 that we had 10,000 publishers in Japan, I could not hold back my tears of joy, and I was moved to promise Jehovah anew. As long as I live, I want to be loyal to you. Imagine how happy I feel today, as we now have more than 216,000 publishers.
Daniel Adogan, aged 83.
When I was baptized in 1950, Nigeria had 8,000 publishers. Today, there are some 351,000. At assemblies, I'm moved when I see so many in attendance, and I think of Haggai 2:7. Jehovah is really shaking the nations, and the precious things are coming in. I still try to do as much as possible in the preaching work, because preaching is my way of saying, "Thank you, Jehovah."
Carlos Silva, aged 79.
We had 5,000 witnesses in Brazil when I was baptized in 1952. That year we had an assembly in a gymnasium in São Paulo. There were two cars in the parking lot. A brother pointed to the nearby Pacaembu Stadium and asked me, "Do you think we'll ever fill it?" It seemed impossible. But in 1973, the stadium was packed with 94,586 in attendance. Today we have over 767,000 dear brothers and sisters in Brazil. It's marvelous to see the increase.
Carlos Casares, aged 73.
In 1954, the year I was baptized, there were 10,500 publishers in Mexico. The need for workers was so great that I was appointed as a circuit overseer at the age of 21. It has been a blessing to see the fulfillment of Isaiah 60:22 before my very eyes. We now have more than 806,000 publishers who are conducting over 1 million Bible studies. It's overwhelming.